Mel's Melbourne Activist Legal Service has made us aware of the Strikeforce Guard 3. Can you explain to my listeners what this is about?
Sure, happy to. We got phone calls on Wednesday of from activists in Victoria and also in New South Wales that were being visited in a very disturbing fashion by police, the local neighbourhood police, who asked them a whole series of questions around their activities and their intentions on leading up to the IMARC, the International Mining and Resources Conference that's happening in Sydney from the 2nd to the 4th of November this year. And activists were a bit puzzled why this was happening. Some had been handed a nondescript form, a protest permission form that's from New South Wales, called the Form 1, that had no jurisdictional information or anything on it, and given also incorrect information that the protest without this form submitted was unlawful, which isn't true. And so we put out a statement on Friday. We instantly started talking to our colleagues and counterparts in New South Wales and Queensland, who also had received similar phone calls, and we realised that there was a quite an alarming preemptive cross-border operation underway. And the name of this is Strikeforce Guard 3. It continues on from the sort of repressive policing that we saw in June this year in Sydney surrounding the actions of Blockade Australia, the climate network.
It's an interesting gambit, isn't it? Because it's not the federal police. This is coming from the New South Wales police, and it implies that citizens are acting illegally when they're organising to advocate for the climate.
Any sort of preemptive policing for a crime that has not yet been committed or alleged crime that hasn't been committed yet is dangerous per se. These sort of visits are also, we should go back for some wider context, is that targeted predominantly Muslim communities in the 2000s were experiencing huge numbers of unannounced visits from ASIO and Australian Federal Police and local police. As part of the counter-terror operations throughout those decades. And so at the time, community legal centres put out legal information for communities about what to do if the police arrived at your home. And we took a similar approach with this. We instantly put out some very simple and accessible legal information about that you don't need to answer questions, you don't need to return police phone calls, you don't need to just have a friendly chat with police, that it's all intelligence gathering. And you don't need to feel intimidated by police, because that's obviously one of the key functions of this operation, is to project the message that you shouldn't go to this protest, that you should be intimidated, that it's potentially unlawful, and that we're watching you. So that level of intimidation is something that is the key concern with this sort of operation.
It's interesting in the context of emanating from New South Wales, but obviously getting the support or backup of Victorian, Queensland, ACT police in a quasi nationwide approach. How does that stack up, for example, in Victoria in relation to our Bill of Rights?
Well, that's a really good question. It's we've seen cross-border anti-protest operations before, and we know there's the sharing of information across borders, but it was really good to see it in operation happening, concurrently. So it was really clear evidence that this was a New South Wales police-driven operation who were gearing up for, their preemptive response to the IMARC potential protests, and using ACT Police, Queensland Police, and Victoria Police as part of their operation. So it was a really clear example of that cross-border cooperation. But also the charter rights in both ACT and Queensland and Victoria, of course, are unique. New South Wales doesn't have a human rights charter, and it's not to say that the policing is necessarily substantially different. But Victoria Police and Queensland Police and ACT Police are obligated to consider the Charter rights, which includes protections around freedom of assembly and political expression. So one of the questions that we've alerted MPs and agencies and accountability bodies is that we want to know if and to what extent Victoria Police considered the Charter rights when they decided to cooperate with this New South Wales operation.
You know, I had a sort of a fantasy moment when I was thinking about this particular thing. If you looked at the operatives at IMUC as climate criminals, that it could be the other way around, that the police, which the normalisation of using police as political arm of government, could actually be investigating them rather than the so-called activists.
Well, yeah, look, it's a very important perspective, is that policing only targets a very narrow range of actual criminality in society, and that a huge array of financial, white-collar crimes against the environment, crimes against women, crimes against society or collective rights are just blatantly ignored within the criminal justice system, and the overwhelming weight of it draws upon the low socioeconomic areas of society. So yeah, that's a really important consideration with any of this sort of policing. The policing verges really close to like special branch political policing that targeted movements throughout the 70s and 80s as well. It's on the police identify criminal or potential criminality within a protest movement, and therefore police it in a way that undermines the basic rights and protections that we enjoy, that we need, we should be enjoying in Australia. So we do have a right to assemble and express ourselves politically, whether or not, and those rights remain whether or not there's any sort of criminality or unlawful or potentially unlawful behaviour within that assembly. It also ignores the fact that any sort of assembly or protest is disruptive by its very nature. And that police are very selective when they choose when that disruption is cracked down upon using police violence or whether it's simply tolerated. So, yeah, there's huge problems with the way police are both perceiving this and their behaviour in actually policing it. So we're seeing this as part of an overarching pattern or an approach of policing throughout Australia that includes quite a vast array of tactics and techniques, and that which include things like intelligence gathering using high-tech and sophisticated methods to surveil and gather intelligence on groups and maintain records on groups and individuals, as well as preemptively targeting groups and trying to undermine their ability to mobilise large numbers. The police's operational imperative is to maintain power and control over protest movements. Once, if they lose that control over groups, that's when they really get worried and scared. So this sort of policing, we call it strategic incapacitation, or policing scholars often call it that, describes approaches that are really explicitly designed to undermine the ability of social movements to grow and build numbers. So that's what we're seeing with these sort of preemptive raids, the preemptive surveillance, and these sort of intimidatory house visits. They're designed really to stop people protesting.
When there was that particular action not so long ago in Sydney, talking to Mark Davis about the defence of those activists, I mean, even the term activists, these are people, the defenders, climate defenders. He was talking about rule books that were created by legislation while common law, natural justice is being overlooked, in fact. This is very political, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. We're seeing, with this whole strategic incapacitation approach, we're seeing collusion between government, industry and police. There is an alignment of purposes and objectives. So we're seeing, in the parliamentary sphere, we're seeing legislation that clamps down on disruptive protests, which explicitly supports particular industries and areas, and an alignment with the heavily resourced police forces in each state, which also provide them with substantial powers to easily manage, or more easily manage and disrupt protest movements. So this strong alignment, it's not necessarily a conspiracy or a direct, but there is a correlation between what's happening, the needs of industry and parliament and policing just aligning. And we're seeing this in various states, in Victoria, of course, with the new forest laws, in Tasmania and Queensland, and also in New South Wales. They provide police with extraordinary powers to provide to clamp down using bail as a form of crowd control outside the purposes of the Bail Act, and also the deterrence of substantial fines.
And it's interesting because you talk about it as preemptive, intimidative policing, and also pointing out the police who are coming to people's homes like this are armed, and further, that you don't actually have to speak to them at all.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so it's alarming at so many levels that when police arrive at your door, young children are answering the door, housemates, family members are being feeling intimidated and threatened by these visits. They are armed. In some cases, counter-terror units have been the ones door knocking. Again, that's just another example of this inexorable use of counter-terror resources against domestic social movements. So that's another global trend that was predicted decades ago. But also, it's generally been local police units, often slightly oblivious as to why they're there. They're just obviously providing some sort of warning from the New South Wales Police. But it's nonsensical as a community safety or policing measure by itself, aside from the very clear objective of intimidation and deterring people from attending the protests. And yeah, basically, and the fundamental thing is, yes, you are under no obligation whatsoever to talk with police under any circumstances. And people on bail conditions might have an obligation to identify and confirm their name, but aside from that, there is no obligation to answer or respond to any of these questions. Police will be looking at trying to find any sort of information they can on the extent and scale of any planned protests at IMARC, and all of that will go into a central intelligence unit who will be planning on that basis. So even friendly chats with police and under these sort of operations can be highly dangerous.
Mel's has got recommendations that you've made, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so we're calling on police to immediately cease these sort of operations and to also release the criteria that on their person of interest list, because that's another thing. It's very secret and opaque why they're visiting particular people. Some people have been involved in protest activity, other people haven't, and haven't received any prior charges and those sorts of things. So there's obviously some sort of list that's been developed.
Who's on it? Who's on the list and why?
That's always deeply concerning. And there's also, because it feeds into police biases and misperceptions and misassumptions about social movements generally. The other main call is that Parliament needs to take responsibility for this. It needs to clamp down and rein in any sort of thing that smells like political policing. It's the parliamentarian's responsibility to make sure that citizens aren't policed in this particular way. It's really important that parliamentarians take responsibility. So we're calling on human rights agencies and bodies to investigate and to look at this really closely, but MPs to really take responsibility for clamping down on it.
Now, this is targeting a particular event that's the IMAC demonstration, Sydney, November 2nd to 4th, the 4th. But this is actually creating a precedent, isn't it?
So these patterns of policing, preemptive policing, have occurred previously, as there's been preemptive raids on organising hubs and so forth in decades past. But, we really need to make sure that it doesn't become the norm. We have to counter the normalisation of this sort of anti-protest policing.
And this conflation of terrorism with demonstrating.
That's right, yeah. Police generally have this view that conflates democratic grassroots social movements, people who have views that oppose government policies, political violence and terrorism. So they often see this trajectory, this synchronicity or conflation. That's highly dangerous. It's fundamental to repressive regimes throughout the world, and it's fundamentally anti-democratic. So it's really important that that again, this is something that's core to policing philosophy throughout the world, and needs to be challenged.
And also, MELS has got some resources for people who may or may not be on the list.
Well, yeah. So simply, there's a social media tile going around, really, that just reiterates you're under no obligation to return a police phone call, to have a chat, to answer questions. So it's worthwhile sharing that around and being really clear on that. Practicing in your own mind what you might do if police knock on your door. Bear in mind, this is very targeted at the moment. It's been 27 visits around Australia that we know of so far. So it's not a huge number. So we're not expecting this to continue beyond much more. But we don't want to normalise it. It shouldn't be those 27 people. And it shouldn't be anyone being visited by police in the middle of the night or day.
But also there's that people are compiling accounts of this police operation for national advocacies, and it's important to actually document this.
That's right, yeah. So movements themselves have been tracking this stuff really well over the last week, people haven't been standing for it. So this sort of stuff thrives in secrecy. Taking detailed notes, videoing the interaction, and then reporting it to local human rights groups or activist hubs is really useful. It's an act of solidarity in itself, and it means that it's not just happening to you in isolation. It's a collective experience, and that means it provides evidence and fuel then for law firms, for legal centres, for human rights advocacy groups to get a picture of what's going on, and take a whole range of responses. So there are legal options potentially available. They're being explored at the moment. There's certainly concerns under both state and international human rights protections. And taking notes and reporting these sort of things is really important.
Thanks for talking to me, Anthony.
Pleasure.